All right, everybody. Good afternoon. Hello, I'm Dr. Amar Nayak. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome and thank you for joining us today for our educational activity entitled Optimizing Ulcerative Colitis Management and Navigating the Challenges and Enhancing Outcomes in Managed Care. I'd also like to know that today's program is supported by an educational grant from Lilly. So, as I mentioned, I am Amar Nayak. I am the director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Program and the founding partner of Midwest Digestive Health and Nutrition. So we are a 12 gastroenterologists and 10 APP advanced practice provider group. After decades in academia, we've started our own independent practice in Chicagoland and take care of complex IBD and many other digestive disorders. So happy to be here, and I want to give everybody else here a chance to introduce themselves, starting with Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Nayak. I am Cheryl Benson. I am a formulary strategy and management pharmacist with CareSource Management Group based out of Dayton, Ohio. In my role as a formulary strategy and management pharmacist, my primary focus is marketplace or healthcare exchange formulary management and strategy opportunities, and my background is in specialty pharmacy. Dr. Spiegel?
Well, thank you. Hi, all. Good to see you. Is everyone enjoying Vegas so far? That doesn't sound too exciting. You guys are very quiet. Well, in any event, I'm Brennan Spiegel. So I am also a gastroenterologist, but I'm also trained in health system science and health economics. So I teach our class in our graduate school, for example, on cost-effectiveness analysis and on value-based healthcare. So I have some comments about that. And I direct digital health science as well for Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. So it's good to be here today with you all.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Spiegel. Dr. Benson. So here we're going to go over just kind of our learning objectives here. And so importantly, our first learning objective is to identify how delays in diagnosis and treatment initiation negatively impact patient outcomes in ulcerative colitis. So these delays. And then we'll be evaluating the economic consequences of suboptimal advanced treatment in patients with moderate to severe UC or ulcerative colitis. And our third learning objective, incorporate the latest data and guidelines for the treatment of UC into population health decisions, taking care of not only a person, but many people. And so very important. These are our three main objectives for today. And kind of turn things over to Dr. Benson here, who's going to talk to you about the importance of overcoming these treatment delays that we have experienced in ulcerative colitis. Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Nayak. All right. So let's get started here with a little interaction from our audience. We will begin with a question. All right. Very good. It seems that we all, for the most part, recognize that the most often noted barrier to advanced therapy is prior authorization. And we will talk about that more as we go through the presentation.
Well, it looks like we have some step therapy requirement there. Maybe they kind of go hand in hand a little bit, huh?
It does at times. That's correct, Dr. Nayak. Yeah. We do see that being required before that advanced therapy option is made available to patients. So, yes. All right. Okay. Now we will kind of touch on the evolution of UC treatment, the landscape of that. And as you can see here before you, there has been a vast expansion in the opportunities of therapies that have been made available. A lot of new therapies are now available to patients that are diagnosed with UC. All right. And let's see here. There we go. All right. Lag in the use of advanced treatments in IBD. So Here for you, we have a little graphing that really speaks to the proportion of patients with any advanced treatment or therapy used during their follow-up. And as you can see, there is quite a bit of a lag in IPD, with Crohn's disease noted at 14.4% and UC at 5.9%. So while that is a lag in IPD within itself, you even see a difference within the two disease states being compared there, Crohn's disease versus IPD, UC. Okay, so if we think about this a little bit more, there are new advanced therapies that are available, but yet we still see patients with UC being treated with 5+ rounds of conventional therapy before they receive that advanced therapy. And many times that conventional therapy includes steroids, 5-ASA, and sometimes the combination of 5-ASA plus steroids being used together. That's the great majority of that. So this graphing just illustrates what you commonly see a lot of times in terms of those 5 rounds of conventional therapy or step therapy that may be required before advanced therapy is an option.
5 rounds are certainly too much for that. And for many things, 5 rounds is quite enough.
It
quite
is.
Quite excessive.
I agree with that, Dr. Nayak. All right, so we've touched on the advanced therapy options being noted. We quickly showed you those available options. But even though there are newer options available, there is a disconnect that we do see between the treatment guidelines and our insurance guidelines. Historically, the treatment of UC was done in a gradual step-up manner, but that is no longer supported by the treatment guidelines. The early initiation of biologic therapy is where the treatment guidelines has moved to. In addition to that, the AGA also suggests that early use of biologic agents with or without an immune modulator is the preferred method of treatment now. But yet, we still have 98% of insurance pathways that still require the use of the conventional therapy being required first before approval of an advanced therapy biologic.
If I can just add something to this. I trained in GI in the early 2000s, and it was back in 2001 when I was training that we had sort of a step-up approach. And that's over almost 25 years ago. And now we recognize that it's far more dangerous to have untreated or poorly treated disease than to start a biologic. There's still concerns that biologics are dangerous medications that are quote-unquote big guns. That's a term we often hear, but our rheumatology colleagues would agree that this has really become the routine approach to managing patients with advanced disease. So we'll talk more about the data behind that, but things have changed a lot in the last 20 years.
That's a great point, Dr. Spiegel. We had a virtual question come in from our virtual audience that I think touched exactly on this. They're asking, which factors behind, besides these insurance barriers, led to delays in treatment to UC, and perhaps it's some of this old guard of the old thoughts that kind of permeate in what your experiences have been.
And as a result, we continue to see far too many people on steroids long-term, not just for a week or 4 weeks or 4 months, a year. That's completely unacceptable in 2024. Even AI knows, you can't treat people with steroids that long. So we got to do better than AI. Let's just start with that.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Dr. Spiegel. 25 years ago, we're still seeing this same treatment approach. It does speak to the challenges that we do see with treatment delays as a result of prioritization. And the IPD Partners Insurance Survey also speaks to those barriers. 72% of patients experience an insurance mandated barrier to treatment. And would you not expect 51% of those reported prior authorization being that biggest barrier? Coming in next would be medication denial, step therapy, and medication change. And the impact of those barriers, Dr. Spiegel did speak to that a little bit. With the prior authorization, you see an increase in the corticosteroid rescue. When you have medication changes, for these patients. You could see continued disease activity, and the medication denials, of course, can lead to UC-related surgery. So let's talk a little bit more about the impact of prior authorization. The physician reported impact on clinical practice, and Dr. Spiegel did give us a real-world report of that, but a lot of it is that we do see is 97% worse than care. These members, or patients, rather, are getting worse when they're not treated. And for the physician, it limits their ability to provide the best care for their members. So in addition to the Dr. Spiegel noting that, yes, there are some thoughts of, okay, you're bringing out the big guns, you want to treat me with a biologic, even before he can even have the option to prescribe the big gun or the biologic, we have to get through these barriers with the prior authorization. So we are seeing that as well with the delayed prescriptions. So it delays the prescription, the prior authorization, getting that approval, the appeals process that comes into play, it delays the member actually having access to the advanced therapy.
You know, it's interesting. They call it prior authorization, but there's also this concept of reauthorization. You know, once you've started treatment, it's not over. It's like having a recurring subscription you have to continue to pay for. And it doesn't have, you know, 3 months, 6 months. There's a time to it, huh?
Yes. Yes, that's true. Healthcare utilization is also impacted because a lot of prescribers, and, I can ask my colleagues here, have you had to experience where the member had to be hospitalized just to expedite the option of a prescription to that advanced therapy, to that biologic? Is that something that you have seen in practice?
Yeah, for sure. I would refer to my IBD, real IBD ologist, as we call it in GI.
Yeah, the IBD. On that. Absolutely. So, you know, this, unfortunately, over the years, you know, and less so currently, but we've had patients being admitted to the hospital, and that's the only way they can get their infusional biologic agent. So we're throwing around biologic advanced. We call them advanced treatments now because we have small molecules also, and so we used to rope them into biologics, but they're, you know, advanced therapies. So we've unfortunately had to do this, and that significantly affects outcomes. You know, we had a question come in about delays in endoscopic remission corresponding to years of life lost, and the years of life lost. The data on that for mortality in inflammatory bowel disease is fraught with, you know, things in statistical here and there, but if you have by disease by extension, sustained inflammation, repeated hospitalizations, operations that carry their own risks. And so arguably it does take away meaningful years and probably also tangible literal years.
Yeah, and I'll touch on this in my comments in a little bit when we talk about cost effectiveness and the upfront costs of an effective therapy can be offset by downstream savings engendered by fewer hospitalizations, fewer procedures, and obviously improved quality of life. But when we talk about, you know, managed care, we're usually talking about per member per month. We're not talking about cost per quality, unfortunately. But as clinicians, it's the qualities that we care about. It's the qualities that we hear about, the quality adjusted life years, the quality of life. So we'll come back to these concepts in a little bit.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the dialogue. And it kind of leads us into our next slide here, the impact of treatment delays. And we did touch on this quite a bit already, but specifically talking about the early versus delayed initiation of advanced therapy in patients with a moderate ulcerative colitis. The time to remission, you know, 10 months for early initiation versus 15 months for delayed therapy. The early initiation of advanced therapy, how that impacts that endoscopy remission that Dr. Nayak touched on. And then lastly, you know, initiating this therapy so that patients can have three times more likely opportunity to achieve that endoscopic remission. Now we've kind of touched on the delays, and we're going to move into what can we do about it? What strategies are there that can help minimize the insurance barriers? Here we have, and I won't read through these naturally, but some of the things here they are real solutions to some of the challenges and barriers that patients and providers do see when trying to treat their UC patients. Prior authorization, step therapy, and restricted access to treatment, kind of streamlining that whole appeals process that is required in order to get that member treated. You know, that with prior authorization being our top obstacle, if you will, to treatment, that's one of the solutions that we have is the appeal process. But we want to think about streamlining that process.
How do you feel about this electronic prior authorization? Is that being like kind of a new thing for everyone to do instead of the forms and the paper and everything? Has that actually helped? Or?
I don't have enough experience to tell you that.
Yeah,
I just don't.
Yeah, it's. I think it's good to have a lot of quick access to and a response right away. And it's supposed to potentially decrease some of the back and forth and the faxing and paperwork and so forth. So I think maybe, I think there will be probably some future mandates on that.
Well, just to be clear, I see patients with very little insurance. I see patients in our teaching clinic where they're underinsured or uninsured. So forget these kinds. I don't even have access to biologics sometimes.
Wow.
Okay. So what we're talking about are the different levels of healthcare access in this country. And this is obviously a model that we're talking about today to get to the point where the people can get the care that they need. But I think the key for the key initial message from this discussion, and we'll talk about this more, is that our patients absolutely suffer. They suffer physically, emotionally, and socially, biopsychosocial. Okay, when we talk about the World Health Organization definition of health, if anyone of you knows the definition of health that the World Health Organization put forward in 1948, it's not just a lack of disease, but it's a complete state of physical, emotional, and social well-being. That's what health means. That's what health should mean. And so that means that our patients can go to work. That means that our patients can take care of their family. Okay, that means that our patients aren't suffering from overwhelming anxiety that the sword of Damocles is going to fall on top of their head at any moment. Okay, that's what we care about in a clinic. And this stuff is really important to figure out the approaches to overcome these barriers. But I just want to be clear about why we're even sitting here today. Okay, it's because of that. And those are the conversations that I'm having in my clinic. Forget this stuff. I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to take care of these patients if I can't get access to these, you know, advanced therapeutics.
Yeah, remission is the mission, but it's only a piece of the puzzle. It's really important.
Yes, and Dr. Nayak, you've just pretty much led me into this next slide, prior authorization reform. There are efforts by the AMA in their positioning on reforming how we actually handle prior authorizations. You know, that volume reduction with gold carding programs and the elimination of prior authorization requirements for certain healthcare conditions or disease states, quick response, and just speaking in terms of from the managed care standpoint, because I do work for a payer, that benefits us as well, you know, in terms of being able to streamline the process, provide that quick response, and not having to go into an appeal, getting that PA approved on that first try for the provider. So the prohibited retroactive denials, things like that are things that we also would like to see improved as well. And making prior authorizations valid for greater than 1 year, regardless of the dose change. Thinking in terms of reauthorization, you know, things like that. How can we improve those types of processes for the patient as well as the provider? And then one thing that really stood out here to me was that prohibiting the requirement of a PA when a patient switches plans. So that you see that all the time where your patients are switching from one insurance to the next and they're still seeing the same provider, but yet the provider may have just, you know, submitted a prior authorization for that patient, and now here they are 6 months later because that patient may have had employment change or whatever the case, and a prior authorization is being required again. So we see those challenges all the time in practice in real time. So now we want to kind of passing on to Dr. Nayak now.
Yeah, well, it is that time of year of open and closed enrollment. Followed very closely by the dawn of the new calendar year, which can raise a lot of complexities in testing and getting things done appropriately. So we had a couple questions come in, and I'm going to bulk a few of them together. Some of them were like talking about forms and studies and streamlining. Are there things that, you know, I have things that I do, but from your aspect, are there things that you like to see, you know, notes that are sent or things that are, you know, that may be helpful, you know, with some of the streamlining some of these reauthorization processes. So we like to have clinical documentation that's very practical and addresses the thing that's needed. I think maybe AI and other things may be able to help with this.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about AI. Certainly my colleagues are using a lot of GPT to write these notes. Yeah. I will say I think it's very valuable to, before even start therapy, figure out what the goal is and document that. What is the clinical goal? Can that be expressed clinically and then put into a note so that we can refer back to that in these conversations with insurance companies so that we can indicate where we are along that treatment path and what's required to get there. And we'll talk about maybe AI and tailoring therapy in a little bit. I'll have some comments about that. But I do think it's really important to be clear what exactly is the treatment goal.
Yeah, it's really important in terms of what we're trying to achieve, what we're trying to avoid, harms we're trying to minimize, what we'd like to see, this test number or this level that things improve.
And that can vary. I mean, if somebody has comorbid psoriasis, let's say, then the treatments may be a little bit different because, different biologics have different efficacy for comorbid, autoimmune conditions, let's say.
That's a great point in terms of helps with therapy selection that be maybe quite a little more nuanced than having something being forced good on a certain path with patients and trying to more personalize treatment approach. We're still waiting for a lot more biomarkers and things to guide therapy, but we have certain clues that we can parse out of experiences and data to say like, hey, well, I need this person's, I guess, diarrhea improved, but their skin must also improve, right?
And with the third. Yeah, I mean, I'm in Los Angeles. We have some patients who are actors, and they can't really afford to have psoriasis on their exposed skin. So that's going to be very important for their, for their professional lives. And that's a real story, right? And so different people have different needs, different biopsychosocial illness profiles. And, our IBD center at Cedars, we see some of the most difficult, complicated cases in the world. And the level of nuance that's happening in those conversations is not paint-by-numbers medicine. It just isn't. And so it's quite frustrating for me to see my colleagues who are the world's top experts in this disease and having to, go back and forth with somebody's not even a gastroenterologist and doesn't know the first thing about this condition, has never sat in a GI clinic in their life. Yeah. So it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of segue into this, we're at a very important, great conference. And so in terms of talking about the role of, and a lot of concepts and themes about the role of managed care and payers and ensuring patients have access to treatment, I think it perhaps isn't a one-size-fits-all, right? But we have to take care of a person and take care of people. And a health plan must be able to do both of those things. And I understand that there's a cost, right? And we have to balance some of those costs and effectiveness and therapy. So I think, making sure that access to treatment, the appropriate treatment is important. And I think we touched a little bit on that and what we need to do for some of those patient populations. So I think now, with further ado, we'll hear more from Dr. Spiegel on health economics in ulcerative colitis, and we'll hold some questions for the end, and I'll continue to monitor things. Please send them in, and we'll take it from there, okay?
Okay, great. So there is a cost to this, notwithstanding my comments about biopsychosocial illness experiences and quality of life. There's hard money being spent on these expensive medications. So it really requires us to take a step back and think about what does it mean for something to be cost-effective? What does value-based care refer to? And so to kind of orient us, I'm going to start with this image here, and I'll fill in the data in a second. But if I were to ask you, and we're here at a managed care conference, what percentage of our GDP right now is dedicated to healthcare? Do you know the answer? Should know the answer. Okay. It's a lot. So over 19%, it's almost as much as we spend on defense is how much we spend on healthcare. That's a tremendous amount of money, $4 trillion maybe. So here is a graph. This goes up through just after 2016, I think it's 2018, not labeled. So a little bit delayed, but you can see the rise, and it's now gone up even a little bit since then, in our GDP as it pertains to healthcare spending. So this raises some questions, and of course we'll focus on UC in a moment, but where's all this money going? How is this money being spent? And so this has been really well worked out. This is research, this is a taxonomy that was developed at the RAND Corporation around waste in the U.S. healthcare system. This is a conceptual framework. All of our graduate students learn this conceptual framework, so I just want to show it to you. And we could spend an entire hour just going through the details of waste in the U.S. healthcare system. And you can see there's three major categories, but today, for this discussion, we're going to be really focusing on the clinical side, because a lot of the administrative stuff is a bit out of our hands, at least as clinicians. You know, we can go to Washington, we can try to change policy, but as a clinician, it's the clinical side that's within our control. And so under clinical, there's this box called cost and effective. And this is the issue where we're providing care that is not sufficiently cost effective. So that requires us to understand, what does that mean for something to be cost effective? That's a term that's used a lot. So I want to spend just a few minutes here explaining literally what we mean when something is cost effective. So some of you may at some point in your career have taken a class on decision analysis or on pharmacoeconomics and cost effectiveness analysis, and you would be familiar with this picture. But if you haven't, you still can be familiar with this picture because it's pretty straightforward. We have cost and we have effectiveness. So if I were to ask you, where would you want a policy or a drug or an intervention to show up in these four quadrants, where would it be? You don't have to say, well, someone's raising his hand even. That's good. That's good. I like that. Where are you pointing? Bottom? Yeah, bottom and right? Yeah. You would want to be something that's as cheap as possible and as effective as possible. That would be wonderful. And we do have examples in medicine of interventions that are cheap and highly effective. Okay, we'll get there in a second. But the way this is broken up is into four quadrants. And so the first quadrant we'll talk about here is up here in the upper left. This is the red zone. This is the area where things are very, very expensive, but not very effective. You would think that we don't do anything here, but unfortunately we do a lot of things here. And that's the first place to focus if I'm paying for healthcare, is to get rid of all those things. So we'll get to that in a second. On the other hand, we have things down here in the bottom right which are highly effective and inexpensive. We should be living there a lot. That's a good place to be. So we can think about the upper left as the so-called thou shalt nots. And you may have heard of the ABIM initiative, Choosing Wisely. Has anyone heard of this before? It's unfortunate that none of you have heard of it, or at least willing to raise your hand, because this came out about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more now. And this was an initiative by the American Board of Internal Medicine to hunt down and remove all of the practices in modern medicine that occupy that red box. The things that we do all the time that are not at all cost-effective. They're not effective, much less cost-effective. So, for example, in our field, in gastroenterology, this would be like somebody gets a screening colonoscopy, and then they get sent back for another colonoscopy 3 years later. That's not cost-effective. It's not even effective. It could be harmful. So every 10 years you should get a colonoscopy if you're average risk. That would be an example of things that thou shalt not do. And we have a list of all those things. And insurance companies should not be paying for them, and doctors should not be doing them. And we have clinical decision support and all sorts of efforts and initiatives to try and stop those things, although they still happen all the time. Bottom right is the thou shalls. These are the things that we all agree with. This is like, you know, parenthood and apple pie and warm hugs. No one could debate these things, like a vaccination, although we do debate vaccinations. I happen to think they're quite effective, and I think the science would support that, but I'm not going to get into politics. But vaccinations is an example of something that we do have excellent data that they work, and they're inexpensive. Now, the issue then becomes the bottom left. We don't really even need to talk about this. In modern American healthcare, we're not really talking about these things, but today's conversation is really about the upper right quadrant. This is where the debates happen. This is why there are CME events to talk about health economics. That's the point of contention in modern American healthcare. It's the upper right quadrant. These are things that do cost a lot of money, but they're also effective. So is the juice worth the squeeze? That's the question. Now, the way we think about the upper right is we split it in half. There's actually two triangles in there. And you can start with this first part on the upper part where it's like, well, now probably shouldn't do these things. Because, yes, they're a little bit effective, but they're also very, very expensive. But as you start to move clockwise, you get into this area where thou probably should do these things. Because after all, we're spending over 19% of our GDP on healthcare. Maybe it makes sense that some of that go towards interventions that are evidence-based and improve the health and well-being of the patients we serve. That would be that area of this figure. So there's lots of examples we can talk about. But the question then is, in IBD, where does this fall? And you see, where do biologics fall, for example? We'll get to that in a moment. So here's an example outside of IBD for a moment. This is a paper I published in Annals of Internal Medicine over 20 years ago. Back then, all of the rage were COX-2 inhibitors. That was a huge deal at the time, these COXIBs. And it was thought that these are superior to non-selective NSAIDs. We did a health economic model. And here I'm just going to show you, after we ran the model, where naproxen shows up and where COX-2 inhibitors show up for the management of rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis. And so there are two dots there. And when there's two dots, the temptation is to draw a line between them, as you did in high school, and maybe even in elementary school. And that line has a slope, and that slope is the rise over the run. You guys remember that? So you have kids, they're learning that. So rise over run, that's the slope. This is just about all you need to know about health economics right here, okay? Because that rise over run is the change in cost divided by the change in effectiveness, and that gives you a value. And in this case, when we worked it out, it was $275,000 per additional quality-adjusted life year gain, or quality gained. That is a lot of money. That doesn't mean COXIBs cost $275,000. That was when we look at everything, all the possible costs, from a third-party payer perspective, it's a very high incremental cost-effectiveness ratio. So now that I've set that up, the way these things work is you look at the two costs and you compare them, and you look at the two effectiveness and you compare those, and then you have delta cost over delta effectiveness, and that's called the ICER, incremental cost-effectiveness ratio. That's how we measure whether something is cost-effective or not. So there's a science behind this. It's not really a subjective thing if something's cost-effective. It's a relatively objective thing that we do with decision analyses, and we run these models, and we get results. So where do biologics fall, then, for cost-effectiveness for treating, in general, inflammatory bowel disease? Although today we're focusing on UC, this is a very useful systematic review, although it's a bit outdated. It's still helpful. They looked at all the existing cost-effectiveness analyses as of that time, and looked at what was the average ICER. And this is in euros, so it was $35,000 euros per quality, which is about $38,000 per quality. And that is cost-effective by any modern standard. Generally, we say if anything is less than $100,000 per incremental quality gain, that is quote-unquote cost-effective. It used to be $50,000. We moved it to $100,000. $38,000 is definitely in the ballpark for what we would consider to be a reasonable use of money in a society that dedicates 19% of its GDP to healthcare delivery. So there are, of course, a variety of individual ICERs, some on indicating that biologics are dominant, to others that have an ICER that's upwards of $1 million. So the question then is, what's the difference between these models? And that comes down to case selection. That comes down to the right treatment for the right patient at the right time, which is something that we need to talk about. So there was another slide here. There it is. Okay. I'll just summarize my comments with these unmet needs, something we can hopefully talk more about. We really don't have enough budget impact models. And earlier I mentioned that managed care is typically not so interested in qualies, quality-adjusted life. You're in socialized healthcare systems, like in Canada, or in the United Kingdom, it is a requirement, in order to even get on formulary in the UK, that a medication go through a formal cost per quality cost utility analysis. In this country, most people don't even know what a quality is. We know what a quality is as clinicians because we literally can see the quality of life of the patient sitting in front of us, and we can estimate that through utilities and qualies. But we need more budget impact models that look at per member per month costs. We don't have enough of those in this field. We need tailored models to individual healthcare systems and their costs. We need to talk more about how can we optimize technologies like AI through clinical decision support to identify the highest impact prescribing opportunities. What is it about a particular individual where they really need a biologic at a certain time, and it will be cost effective, and the computer can predict that? That would be really nice. That is advanced clinical decision support. We don't really have that yet, but it's possible. It's something that we should be aiming towards. We need more comparative effectiveness data. This is an ongoing issue. We're going to hear more about the data behind these various therapies. And we really need to actively involve patients and providers in designing these models and discussing with payers, because all too often these models kind of are made by nameless, faceless people who have never actually been into a clinic. And we need to engage all stakeholders in developing models that are highly reflective of reality. And the last thing I'll add is most of these models are looking at third-party payer perspectives, but they're not really looking at the overall societal costs, the costs I mentioned earlier, like time off from work, productivity, you know, worker presenteeism and absenteeism and transportation costs and all these other costs that insurers do not cover. So I'm going to end there and pass it back to a colleague here. She can take the clicker, and we'll have plenty to discuss.
All right. So now we will talk about the economic impact of suboptimal UC care. And before we get into that, let's have another question. So we have our results here. Many of you thought it was $29,000. The answer is B, $18,000. That is the cost, the increase in cost of care for failure of UC treatment. Half of you thought it was $29,000. But that's still a significant increase in cost at $18,000. All right, so let's talk about the economic challenges in UC management. We have the list here visibly. You can see, we all know that UC has a high cost of care. We've kind of discussed the challenges early on, and Dr. Spiegel kind of took us through some of the economics behind that and understanding that a little bit better, the impact and the overall impact in general. But some of the challenges that we do see is with this high cost of care, disease symptoms and the progression resulting in hospitalization, steroid dependence, we've kind of touched on that, and surgery. Treatment often fails or members have inadequate responses to treatment. Adverse event management. We have switching of therapy to improve the response. We see that all the time. Dose change also adds to the cost burden, you know, especially when you have the delayed initiation and then it's not sufficient for the member, then they have to switch to a higher dose. So we see all of that as economic challenges in UC management.
And there's direct costs, indirect costs. There's just the dollar amount is just the beginning,
right, yes,
of the aspect of it. So, but nevertheless, it's still quite impressive.
Yes.
Absolutely.
The cost of UC treatment. So we're just going to highlight here really quickly the average annual cost of advanced treatment, a little more than $42,000. The cost of adverse events, serious events around $7,000, serious infections around $10,000, and the average cost of surgical care at $40,000. So here you can kind of see where this cost of care for UC is coming from.
I mean, look at serious infections, long-term corticosteroids significantly increases that risk. We don't have to get into the cost of taking care of a diabetic patient, but, you know, certainly that can occur. Things like bone loss, fractures. So there's a lot more that comes into the cost of the managing disease, and the cost of managing the disease incorrectly is almost exponentially increased.
I think all in, IBD as a category, the studies are anywhere between $15 and $30 billion per year. In healthcare expenses.
Absolutely.
Which is a hugely disproportionate amount of expenditures for set of conditions that affects about 0.5% of the population.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a question that came in kind of on QALY, and I wasn't aware of, and I think it's too soon yet for QALY as a vital 23 and inflammatory bowel disease, so data on that. Mm. But I think it's data that we need to fill. And I think I'm looking forward to some of those things, some of the questions. And the other thing, before I step into, is can we trust AI in this way? And I think I may have made an off-the-hand comment of, and a lot of it has to be with the programming and how you train it. And I don't know if you want to touch on that a little bit.
Well, we can talk AI all afternoon, and yeah. I would love to, but I think that'll be a little off topic. But yeah, I mean, you know, we should talk more about what role AI can play in helping to rapidly go through charts and identify opportunities and hotspot individuals that might benefit from certain therapies. And we're doing that actively right now at Cedars-Sinai, and a lot of large health systems are using AI in many different similar ways. And, you know, I think AI with a rudder, we can trust. I will say as an aside, AI will not replace doctors. AI will not replace pharmacists. But doctors who use AI will replace doctors who don't. Pharmacists who use AI will replace pharmacists who don't. Healthcare systems that use AI will replace healthcare systems that don't.
Very nicely put. I think it's the help. It's the help and the assistance. But I loved how you said that. That's fantastic. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, it made me chuckle a little bit. But it was an important question, I thought.
Yeah. Well, I took a dig at AI earlier. I said even AI knows that you can't use steroids for a year.
So. All right. So the impact of biologic therapy on the overall cost of care. Here we see what prior treatment versus 1 year of follow-up, inpatient hospitalization. Of course, that prior treatment, the percentage is pretty high, but after 1 year of follow-up, there is decreased in that percentage. The cost per patient, those totals we have here for your viewing, the emergency department visit, outpatient visit, and, of course, pharmacy costs. Prior to treatment, you know, it's a little bit less, but at that 1 year follow-up, we do see an increase in cost. So this is the overall cost of care when we're thinking of the biologic therapy. And here we have the cost of treatment failure. So we previously touched on the cost of care. Now what happens, what's that impact when we don't treat the member the patient? And here you see this graphing that displays that for us. The average all cost, 12-month cost here for treatment failure is at almost $75,000 here. The persistent cohort at $56,000. And then you're looking at the UC-related 12-month cost. Again, treatment failure at $57,000, and then the persistent cohort at $47,000. So the point here of this is just to bring home that we initially started with this poll question of what is the cost of failure, and we noted it as $18,000 of increased annual cost. So that is the cost of this suboptimal treatment when we are not initiating our therapy with the biologic earlier rather than later.
Unfortunately, sometimes despite best efforts, therapies aren't working as long as we'd like them. For a condition that does not have a cure yet, these are long-term treatments. And so the cost of losing that therapy and then adding another therapy, it's understandable. So if we can somehow, you know, figure out which one is going to potentially work, that'd be, you know, really important and nice. And a lot of factors come into play, right? Adherence, modality of treatment, the disease changing, the patient changing over the years as they age. And so when they're 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, other health conditions impact this. So it's just the complexities are great. And so that initial sometime that decision is important. But I've read somewhere, you know, it's not necessarily decisions, how you, you know, follow up and enact that decision that you have. And that will get into the treatment afterwards. And so it's like
that really focuses on shared decision making and the idea of ensuring that whatever therapeutic is selected is acceptable to the patient. So we created a website several years ago called IBD and Me. And it's actually a conjoint analysis which is a technical term. Basically, this is an online tool that patients can use to answer questions about their preferences. And it will navigate them through these questions and then identify among various biologics which one seems to align best, completely independent of cost or sponsor, just which one seems to align best with their preferences. Now, whether that ends up being, you know, what we can actually get for them is a different question. But this idea of SDM is very important.
Yeah.
And lastly here, before we leave this discussion of the economic impact, we want to definitely think about the impact on the patient. What is the cost of care for patients? The Crohn's and Colitis Foundation's Cost of IBD Care Initiative kind of helped pull out some information for us here. And these patients with IBD, they do have higher health care costs. We noted the cost of care. We know you see cost of care is substantial, if you will. But compared to patients without IBD, you know, our UC patients or IBD patients are 3 times increase in direct care costs, 2 times increase in out-of-pocket costs. And the average cost burden in the first year following diagnosis is $26,000, actually a little bit more than that. So there is a cost burden that our patients do see as a result of this diagnosis. And we should, you know, kind of bear that in mind when our members are, pardon me, patients are being treated, coming into the office. And this is something to think about, because at the end of the day, we're talking about all of these opportunities that we have for improvement. But I like how Dr. Spiegel kind of brings it home and makes it real time for us, because there's a patient at the end of all of these decisions that we make and all of these discussions.
Yeah, I just want to provide a little more context around this, save a bit of time. You know, Hippocrates said a long time ago, he said, all disease begins in the gut. And, of course, in gastroenterology, we like to think that's true. That's a little facetious, but not really. The brain and the gut communicate. We know that conditions like irritable bowel syndrome, for example, are very complicated conditions that have to do with the way the brain, the gut, and the microbiome interact. But the same applies to inflammatory bowel disease. This is a condition that's not just a GI condition whatsoever. It's a condition that certainly predominantly affects the gut, but it's a condition that affects almost all body systems in one form or another. It absolutely affects emotional well-being and anxiety and depression and suicidality, and I talked about this earlier. It's a condition that affects the skin. It's a condition that overlaps with many other autoimmune conditions. And so this is, when we see data like this, these are just numbers. But really what these numbers are reflecting is the complexity of a condition that goes way beyond just being a GI bowel problem. It's never that. It's never just that. It's always way more complicated than that. So it goes back to my earlier conversation or my earlier point about can't really paint by numbers in managing these kinds of patients. These are very specialized patients. I don't really even see these patients. We have IBDologists, my colleagues at Cedars-Sinai, are the ones who, that's all they do. It's all they do. Nothing else. It's just see these patients. That's how complicated they are. So I really just want to put a point on that. And, you know this better as well as anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're seeing a dermatologist, even if they don't have dermatology problems for skin cancer surveillance, which is arguably increased with certain treatments. Mm-hmm. They're seeing rheumatologists. They're seeing their primary care physician team there, who are just trying to keep ahead of that. So
vaccinations.
Right. Healthcare maintenance is really important. They're dealing with occasionally an ulcerative colitis, you know, an increased colon cancer risk that we have to get specialized
in. The hepatologist for the PSC that starts to develop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so it's just the tip of the iceberg here, just the gut. You know, I do think that it's the diseases of endodermal origin are the key, to a
That's
lot
right.
of these things. It's how you address taking care of your children early. The GI tract governs all, right? Poopy diapers and diet. And so we had a couple questions come in. I wanted to keep in terms of cost of care. There was a question talking about IV versus home injections. And a lot of the therapies, advanced therapies, I'm talking more biologics, have pivoted to offering maintenance strategies that can be done by self-injection, kind of putting the care in the hands of the patient. Therapies that were initially approved for just IV treatments have now also have injection, options like And certainly the new IL-23 class all throughout starts with infusions and then mm-hmm. pivots to an injection. So the question was more of like how that impacts cost, and certainly gets more complicated from patients' plans, health plans, because obviously an infusion will come from one section. The benefit for their home injections are going to come from a different area. So the cost to patients sometimes can be quite prohibitive and complex in getting therapies approved for the injection mm-hmm. and the IV, which come at different times. And so do you guys see some of that? I think overall it would make sense to me that it's having an injection for maintenance is technically less costly indirectly for the patient to come to an infusion center, even get infusions delivered to a nurse and monitoring, et cetera. So what's your kind of guys' perspectives on some of these things and what should we focus on there?
In general, as you see these therapies advance and improve, definitely it decreases the cost in terms of if they're on the IV initiated therapy from an IV standpoint or infusion, of course, that's likely to be under their medical benefit. And then when they are switched to maintenance, then that therapy then now typically will go under their pharmacy benefit. So, of course, there's a decrease in cost. You kind of touched on it. You don't have to have that nurse coming out, possibly, if they were able to get their infusion at home initially anyway. So you have that decrease in cost, and which is huge, you know. And that definitely within itself provides a decrease in the cost of care for patients and the plan.
Oh, that's great. The other kind of question was not necessarily a medical treatment, but food is medicine, perhaps, or, you know, and as it was about diets and their efficacy, and it is an area that needs a lot more research. I think some of the best data are in children with Crohn's mm-hmm. disease, right? Elemental diets and enteral nutrition diets. It's fantastic induction data, getting people healing their intestines. And so we are still looking for higher quality, and there's lots of work being done on this, and we think the mechanism of action is probably altering the microbiome. You are what you eat, more bacterial DNA in our body than our own, perhaps, but there are certain dietary strategies that can help patients feel better in irritable bowel syndrome, also looking at FODMAP, low FODMAP right. diets, et cetera. So, I mean, you guys have any experience in diet, as food as a diet? Or as
yeah, we have an IBD nutritionist, and as you mentioned, in some cases, patients with IBD will be in remission, be in deep remission, and they're still having ongoing abdominal pain, diarrhea, and then everyone scratches their head and says, oh, how can this possibly be? We do an endoscopy, and the inflammation's gone. And well, the body's not so straightforward. It's more complicated than that, and they may actually have IBS at the same time as having IBD. Chronic visceral inflammation, even if the viscera is healed, does not stop the brain from firing off and feeling like it's under attack. Kind of like, it's not a great analogy, but it's an analogy that's been used is like phantom limb pain. After an amputation, people will have terrible pain in the arm that's not even there anymore. The brain thinks it's there. And so when the brain's been under attack for years by an inflamed colon and intestine, it still hurts even when all that goes away. So we have to think about other non-pharmacological approaches, you know, diet therapy, for example, but also even we're using virtual reality therapy, working with David Rubin now at University of Chicago, using VR therapy as a non-pharmacological approach to managing stress and anxiety, gut-directed hypnotherapy, all these kinds of things in IBD.
No, that's fantastic. I think we're just tipping that, and taking care of someone with a chronic health condition is very challenging and can lead, you know, patients also experience that the benefit of their effective treatment, whether they have symptoms that are not related to inflammation, they become a little less akin to continue effective therapy. And so having these kind of adjuncts together can help improve long-term maintenance treatment for patients who really need it. Mm-hmm. And so these things are really necessary, and you need a whole care team to do this. It's not any one pharmacist, advanced practice provider, gastroenterologist. It's not any one person. You need a team, the teamwork to make the dream work kind of standpoint. Right. So in terms of dealing with insurance denials, you know, we deal with these in a variety of ways, right? I would imagine sometimes we have to pick therapies that their insurance will cover, whether they might not be our first choice. That's probably one of the things that happens occasionally. And sometimes we have to potentially try to appeal, and that's a whole other peer-to-peer. What's an appeal? What's a written one? What's an oral one? Can you fax one? Can you send a singing telegram? There are a lot of ways. I've not done that one yet. I've done a few interesting things in the past, but not the singing telegram yet. But, I mean, what is your... I'm just talking about some of the strategies you use or you see used. Dealing with some of these are important. I guess some of... I will say this, not to hold, jump on. We need all the P's together, the payers, the patients, the practitioners, everyone. Obviously, this is born out of, at some point, a way to be practical and cost-effective, et cetera, but certainly they've probably seen things that are inappropriate when they're treating.
Absolutely.
I will say that. But, you know, some of these denials, you know, is it just asking why, or is it sometimes... hey, we just didn't get that paper you sent us. We didn't get that note, so we didn't see anything, so we just denied it. And so sometimes it's getting that process organized. Are there things that are always important to send and look for?
Yeah, I think that's probably the number one issue that a lot of times we will see with the denials, is that we don't, the plan in general will not receive all of the necessary information initially. So you will receive the prior authorization request, but then it's lacking in everything that is needed as mandated, if you will, or required by that criteria that has been established. So that's the part of it. And that, again, is just delaying treatment for the patient, because you can tell I work for a plan. I keep referencing member versus patient. But that's part of it. A big part of it is that you don't receive everything that's needed initially.
I do want to add, I mean, I think we've said this implicitly but not explicitly, that sometimes claims should be denied. Okay, sometimes clinicians do make inappropriate decisions. Sometimes a biosimilar might be an okay approach, which we haven't talked about. Sometimes the chart doesn't have enough information about what the goals of care are. So, you know, it's not like this is a one-way street, even though we may be a bit biased as clinicians. We see one side of this. On the other hand, these are very expensive medications. They should be used correctly, as all medications should be. But when you have a medication or a class of medications that are very expensive, do have risks, although generally very safe, but do have some risks, it's really vital. There's a pressure on the clinicians to ensure that it's the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. So in the end, this is why, you know, a general gastroenterologist like me doesn't do a lot of this work. It's so specialized, not just in the clinical management, but in the logistics, in the documentation, and in the planning around how best to put these claims in. You know, that's an art unto itself.
Yeah, I know you're kind of like a tech wizard, but you literally are picking up the questions as they come in minutes at a time. So you may have a feed.
Actually, I'm reading them in my brain. Yeah.
These are special glasses that you need.
I have a Neuralink chip in my head, I guess.
Excellent. It's coming. Absolutely. You know, there were some other, you know, that we talk about biosimilars, et cetera. And I think eventually they do decrease lots of data from across the pond where they can be quite effective, in the right hands. And I think it's a necessity. You know, there are some other questions that we could talk a little bit about. First of all, like costs of monitoring and management. I guess how can we decrease costs? I think I'd like to say that, you know, monitoring and management with effective tests are important. For example, patients, one of the blood tests that can be elevated in inflammatory bowel disease when there's a disease flare is the C-reactive protein. Now, but it isn't everybody. So if you know someone's colon looks like something from Arby's on the inside when you scope, and you know the CRP at that same time was normal, then you, my friends, have an ineffective biomarker. So you can save money by never checking that CRP again for that patient. So benchmarking surrogate biomarkers with more expensive tests that come less frequently can help. Now, we can't base everything on them. I think there's been a lot of evidence in medicine basing everything solely on surrogate biomarkers and in the HIV, lots of areas, right? And so I think benchmarking things and trying to do the best is probably one way. So not doing things that are as ineffective, not getting a colonoscopy every year for that one.
Do you find that fecal calprotectin is a useful tool for these denials?
Yeah, so fecal calprotectin is interesting. We're getting better in terms of getting coverage for the actual test. And initially, you know, in the earlier scheme, it was come as experimental. So the patients would come back and like, you're ordering experimental tests, even though it's in the data,
in
the guidelines now, in clinical trials. But they're not perfect, but they're really, really good. And it's a great longitudinal tool. where if you're looking for authorization for medicine, like, have you checked a fecal calprotectin in the last 6 months? No? Okay, why? You know, and so I think there are very important questions that they ask, and you should have those answers. Mm-hmm. An inpatient with a moderate to severe ulcerative colitis should probably have a fecal calprotectin twice a year to know that they're in remission. Now, it's not perfect because inflammatory, non-precancerous colon polyps can also increase fecal calprotectin. If you've stored it in your car trunk for 6 or 7 hours, and then that could also, if it's not the first morning stool. And so there are lots of little things that can kind of elevate them. Polyps can, right? And so, again, benchmarking them together, not any one thing is going to be perfect. Even a normal colonoscopy, if you never intubated the terminal ileum for Crohn's disease, which we haven't talked a lot about today, obviously, you know, nothing's perfect, but we can have a picture that we can paint to longitudinally manage patients with decreased cost. And there are things we can even asynchronously check, right? Like in terms of, you know, patient-reported outcomes or PROs. Mm-hmm. Ulcerative colitis is a tad easier. You're going to have rectal bleeding. You're going to have the rectum involved, so diarrhea, urgency, which has been a new kind of a subjective measure that can kind of have objective data on. So, you know, valuing some of those things.
Like,
and then
you document the Pro-2, Pro-3. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Those are the short, quick, like two or three item questionnaires. You can standardize and use it every visit.
Yeah, every visit. You can arguably use it in between visits and have it sent automatically with guided AI, you know, and have it come into your system. So we've done a lot of, you know, obviously population health in that sense, that can then be fine-tuned and get someone before they get into trouble.
So we do have, we got to get to your comments, but we have a system that uses AI, getting back to AI for a second, where the AI will email the patient and will conduct a conversation, an actual natural language conversation in a HIPAA-compliant environment. A patient can talk to the AI on a phone, on a tablet, on their computer, on a telephone, and it will walk them through not only what's going on, but it'll also, based upon that whole conversation, write a note. It'll just write the note, and it'll put it in the chart. So we created that system. We're testing it right now, validating it. It's extremely accurate. It's very, very effective. Patients really surprisingly enjoy talking to this robot because it's a very empathic robot, and it's, you know, it takes all the time that they need, and it asks really good questions, really good follow-up questions.
I read a study, and I'm not going to be able to remember which one, but they looked at physician responses to chart messages.
Yes, exactly the study.
And AI responses, and most people enjoyed the AI responses.
Yeah, there's a paper in JAMA, and they looked at the how empathic was the physician versus the AI, and how high quality was the result. And the thing is, they actually didn't know who generated the answer. It was a written answer, and consistently the AI was considered far more empathic and higher quality than the doctors. So not to get too far afield, but AI is going to challenge all of us to be the best versions of ourselves we possibly can be. We have to now actually outdo the AI. We have to be better at communicating, at looking people in the eyes, at examining them, at sharing wisdom and shared decision making, looking at body language, the kinds of things that we went into healthcare for, not to, like, you know, put in insurance claims. None of us went into medicine for that.
Excellent. Well, getting into their novel therapies that will have some assistance to go with in population health decisions in UC, we'll kind of pivot right into this here. So let's get some questions. So which of the following ulcerative colitis treatments is only approved for use in patients who are resistant or intolerant to TNF inhibitors? The correct answer is upadacitinib, which is a JAK inhibitor. So upadacitinib in the United States can only be used where patients who have failed, resistant, or intolerant to TNF inhibitors. The other advanced therapies, onasemab, the S1P class, guselkumab, the IL-23s, and vedolizumab, the alpha-4 beta-7 anti-integrins, can be used even if you've not had experience with the TNF inhibitors. So there we have it. So we have some things to learn about. We'll kind of get into this. So the JAK inhibitors are very powerful class, but can only be used in patients who have or resistant or intolerant to TNF inhibitors. This is very complicated. Look at all these therapies. And so, you know, it's quite complicated and complex in terms of how we have to position. So there's lots of challenges here. Therapy changes are often required, you know, in patients who have response or primary response or secondary loss of response. And there is a documented resistance to standard therapies or our originator biologic therapies like TNF inhibitors. And then we have some limited treatment options after them. And arguably some patients don't do as well with the subsequent treatments after being on TNF inhibitors. So side effect profiles are very important. So the the risks, the benefits and harms of the disease that's untreated, and the treatments themselves, and then the complications from unopposed inflammation. So there's a reluctance that we see sometimes of patients who try advanced therapies. It can be risky, and patients' perceptions of risk are all very important to address, and there can be a variety of reasons, whether they're uncomfortable with, you know, using an injection or using other things that they have read. So we have to at least address what, on a person-to-person basis, what some of those risks and some of those reluctances are. And we talked on this earlier, many patients just simply can't afford the cost of treatment, even if it's something like getting an IV first and then not being able to practically afford the injection treatments on their pharmacy plan later on. So we need a lot of alignment and understanding of what things are going to be improved to. And remember, the risks of someone to get better are different than the risks of someone who is better and wants to stay better. And so we have to be aware of how that may change over time. And so this STRIDE-2 criteria, our way we take care of IBD patients, has also gone a parallel innovation, revolution, I should like to say, right? We have all these different classes of medicines. We have biosimilars. We have other things. And we have advanced therapy, small molecules, biologics. But we also have different ways to take care of patients. We can't simply just ask them, how are you doing? You doing well? Great. Here's your refill. Keep going. And we need to actually have objective criteria and be able to follow them. So clinical response, clinical remission. Clinical response is generally you're better, but you're not all the way there. Clinical remission is basically this PRO2, which you talked about earlier, rectal bleeding, stool frequency score, this partial Mayo score, things that we do all the time that get assigned names to it. We use in research and can use in clinical practice if done well. We have patient-reported outcomes, biomarker normalization, the calprotectin, C-reactive proteins, things like that. And then endoscopic healing, where we have to heal the mucosa. We know patients who we have healed the mucosa, they do better. Do we get there in everyone? No. Have we even got there in everyone with the earlier therapies? We didn't have endoscopic healing in the earlier therapies, but thankfully, every new treatment that gets approved, we have endoscopic healing data, and it's an important part of our therapies. And this is not all encompassing exhaustive, and there will be more. This will double, I would predict, in the next 5 years. But so we have ozanimod, the S1P receptors, and upadacitinib, the JAK1/2 inhibitors. You can kind of tell by the names. MOD is a modulator. IB is an inhibitor. MAB are biologic. There are little clues there in what they do. We have mirikizumab, IL-23, etrasimod, an S1P receptor modulator, and guselkumab and risankizumab. We have three IL-23 antagonists here. For adults with moderate severe active UC, right? And so again, remember the JAK1 and 2 inhibitor, moderate severe UC, but they've had to have had inadequate response or intolerance to one or more anti-TNF blockers, right? The others don't have that, but that's an important thing here. So looking at, just delving into a little bit of a data-heavy dive here, looking at mirikizumab and UC induction, LUCENT-1 trial, we have, you know, the things that we looked up before, clinical remission, clinical response, endoscopic remission, and histologic endoscopic mucosal improvement. We're actually, which is technically for STRIDE criteria, like experimental. But it's important to show that there is evidence of histologic healing pretty early with even induction, and endoscopic healing pretty quick. In clinical practice, we're probably not, you know, getting colonoscopies 3 months after everybody, right, which is important to have surrogate markers. But we're having, you know, statistically significant differences with the, you know, in terms of patients compared to placebo, in induction and UC. So in terms of long-term follow-up, this was presented at Digestive Disease Week this last May. We have data up until week 104 for clinical response and for patients in clinical remission at week 104. There are a variety of different ways and statistics of how they utilize this data. Obviously, you know, in looking at patients, you have a little natural lower amount when you watch them over a longer period of time, but this is still interesting data to suggest that patients who do well can continue to do well at a high proportion. In terms of safety, for mirikizumab, treatment-emergent adverse events, we love acronyms that make sense, but they're quite low. Adverse events, yes, they're, you know, you see some there, infections all, but they're non-serious, and there are, you know, no boxed warnings here for mirikizumab, which is great, and importantly, no malignancies here and very small rates of injection site reactions. Guselkumab, another IL-23. This is a quasar 12-week endpoint, so hitting its primary endpoint at a variety of doses here. We're definitely showing clinical remission, symptomatic remission. We like seeing that big differences between the blue and the gray placebos, and so in terms of its dose ranging study, this is a quite new therapy that is just FDA approved, an IL-23 inhibitor. So we still have endoscopic healing, normalization, et cetera. So we can feel good that we're actually having really effective IL-23 inhibition in UC and showing really great efficacy. In terms of safety, the safety of the IL-23 class seems to be really pretty great, a very safe infusion. This is not a weight-based infusion like our infliximab, where you loved calculating everyone's weights and not knowing how much we needed, so which is great in terms of what we'll do, and a very safe therapy, no malignancy signal here early on in the clinical trials. And so looking at risankizumab induction and 12-week remission, clinical response of a treatment difference of close to 14%, and clinical remission even in quite there, pretty low. This is 12-week data, and so, you know, patients with moderate to severe disease that have struggled for quite some time. You'll see patients in clinical trials have had disease for sometimes 6 or 7 years, right, and they've had not done well. And so this is really important, and we have the doses for IV, and remember, we have, again, the transition between IV to sub-Q, which typically occurs, you know, at 4 weeks after that last infusion. So there's a timing amount where we need to start getting therapy approved, and as you kind of get down to your monthly treatment. So really pretty important. And safety, again, risankizumab, treatment emergent adverse events, really no major differences statistically compared to placebo. You know, placebo is not as effective. Some would argue some of the numbers are arguably a little higher, but nevertheless, we feel really pretty good about really effective approved therapies that we have for IL-23 inhibitors and ulcerative colitis. So these are therapies that are not going away. They're therapies that should be used effectively. Again, ozanimod, an oral once daily S1P inhibitor. The True North study hit their week 12 endpoints for clinical remission, clinical response, endoscopic improvement, mucosal healing. So this is a fantastic treatment approach, S1P modulators for ulcerative colitis. And so looking at safety here, the S1Ps are not to be used during pregnancy. We know that. But they can be, we can keep an eye out for cardiovascular arrhythmias, which patients should be screened for, and dermatologic malignancies prior, and diabetic patients should have an eye exam as well for macular edema, et cetera. And so bradycardia rates that we talked about here, their receptors of S1P on their heart muscles, they were quite low. And in the clinical trials, over 90% of the patients really met, 90, 95, 99% of the patients met treating criteria. So, and etrasimod is another S1P blocker. Subtle differences in the receptor subtypes really kind of evaluated ulcerative colitis patients. The clinical remission data for week 12 and week 12 induction and week 52 maintenance were quite significant here as an oral therapy for moderate severe UC patients. So very similar class-like effects in terms of heart cardiac arrhythmias, et cetera. And I apologize, you guys are hinting in there strong, diving through all this hard data. So I truly, truly appreciate it here. And in the upadacitinib, or UC induction, week 8 endpoints and you accomplish and you achieve, really quite effective. If you can see percentages approaching up to that 70% clinical response and clinical remission, endoscopic improvement. I will say for upadacitinib, it's quite important to vaccinate for shingles during maintenance. There is a signal there, obviously, and we have to be cautious about the reason that it's a TNF inhibitor failure requirement was based on the rheumatologic data from oral surveillance with tofacitinib, a non-selective JAK inhibitor, where there was higher rates of cardiovascular negative outcomes, myocardial infarctions, pulmonary embolism. So caution there if there's a history of venous thromboembolism, PEs, and so that's kind of born. That's where some of that data is coming out from. And so, but very effective. We're not seeing some of that data here in the IBD population, but really effective therapies and those TNF non-responders. So obviously now it comes to positioning and what your payer is going to approve, frankly. And so there are treatments that can be used. And in patients who have failed with prior anti-TNFs, you can use ustekinumab or upadacitinib. There are subtleties in failure, different kinds of failure. Did you call the wrong number, or did you have the wrong number that you then correct the wrong number that you called, right? What was the issue? How long ago did you fail? How bad was the disease? And so there are, all of these therapies have actually in the clinical trials been evaluated in advanced therapy naive and advanced therapy experienced patients. but we're seeing patients here very similar results. We're seeing some you know, for biochemical remission, slightly higher rates here. And so this is data here, not a controlled trial, but you know, interesting and thought-provoking nonetheless that there are other therapies you could be used. Upadacitinib safety in UC, again, we talked about the black box warning, increased risk of serious heart-related events, but then you kind of weigh those risks and benefits together when the disease is severely active, and so still pretty effective and not seeing a lot of those major adverse cardiovascular events in the UAchieve clinical trial program. So we have to continue to monitor our patients and take care of the entire patient that has the disease, not just the ulcerative colitis. So positioning therapies is really quite complex, and we have to think about the medication, we have to think about the patient, and in terms of the medication, we think about how well does it work, how quick does it work, does it stay working for a period of time, are there pharmacokinetics that are there, there's drug level monitoring, which we won't get into, that's my other soapbox of what we do, and there's some data on the TNF blockers, but very poor data otherwise in all the other classes, frankly, and then combined treatment approaches with immunomodulators, the old approach, and positioning and sequencing data, right? And so safety is important in terms of infection, cancer risks, health maintenance, vaccinations, et cetera. And there are some specific concerns with the classes. We talked about the JAK inhibitors, higher rates of shingles, and the blood clots and thromboses, TNF inhibitors with melanoma skin cancer for very low rates, right? The thiopurines have some of that non-melanoma skin cancer risk. And so that patient, we also want to take into account how old they are, where they are in their disease, right? Do they just have left-sided colitis? Do they have their whole colon involved? Do they have other comorbidities like psoriasis we talked about earlier, rheumatoid arthritis that may, not like we want to kill any birds with stones, but we'd like to definitely make sure we treat the entire patient and their systemic inflammation. So disease behavior, complications, disease severity and activity are different. Disease severity may be features like young, extraintestinal manifestations, most of their colon. Disease activity is like how high their CalPro is at any point in time. So getting both those things together can help us kind of make decisions. And when you see that patient or hear about that patient in practice, you want to just keep it simple and keep a three-pronged approach and take a step back and stop and say, okay, is this patient in remission? Do we have to get there? Were they in remission and they fall out? And then next, think about like calling it the next thing you think about, the drop. What test do I have that actually works? What's effective? How can I measure this? And have I measured it before? Let's initiate it. And then the role is, I like to say, is basically, it's basically, hey, is this a high-risk or low-risk patient? How hard was it to get into remission? How much leeway, how much slack will I have? And so that's different for everybody, let's just be honest. And those are some nuances that are very difficult. So getting into that stop, drop, and roll, think about that. The initial way, we all know how to put out fires that way, right? And so keeping it simple for all these complexities is very important. And then, communicating some of those nuances in your clinical documentation. So we look at symptoms, we look at biomarkers, we look at endoscopy, we look at prior behaviors, how many flares have they had, what's the steroid course? A steroid course can be a 7-course meal, or it could be picking up some fast food, so it can be a variety of lengths. So again, high risk factors for colectomy, young age, extensive colonic inflammation, deep ulcers, so not all ulcers are created equal, right? How bad does that look? Mm-hmm. Kind of the peak and shriek, we go into the colon, begin the colonoscopy, like, okay, that's enough. And so, patients who have been hospitalized, at higher rates of colectomy over the next year, right? So, and then obviously looking for infections that could be there and pouring more gas on the fire, right? C. difficile, cytomegalovirus infections can be appropriately assessed and treated in the right way. So looking at data of population health, so how you take care of that patient is really important. How you take care of all the people in your practice is also very important, right? So we have to do a good job on an individual level and how you take care of patients at a collective whole. So these SMART goals are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And so they can sometimes help you overcome insurance-mandated barriers to treatment, such as prior authorizations. We want to increase remission rates, reduce disease-related hospitalizations and surgeries. We want to incorporate methods, right, to reduce the overall cost of treatment for patients and payers. You want to identify patients, for whom novel treatment options may be the best option to improve outcomes. That's the best therapy for your patient. You have to fight for your patient. And you will eventually, doing a good job, take care and improve outcomes and reduce the unplanned healthcare resource allocation, right? So when that payer sees that your patient's not going to the hospital, not going to the ER, not getting 20,000 CT scans that are going to show colon inflammation, It's going to be better. Your care is going to be, the costs are going to be deviated, and the health patients are going to feel better. We want to make sure we propose alternatives, right, to increase access to treatment for uninsured patients, which we didn't even really touch on too much except for Dr. Spiegel earlier, but that's also another option, in utilizing any strategy we can to get our patients the right therapy. So, again, kind of leave it up for some question and answers. We're kind of going into this, so it's the first one here. I'll kind of get into the stop, drop, and roll concept that people are talking about. So I coined this after how, you know, the most effective public health, you ask a 5-year-old, a 20-year-old, an 80-year-old, if you're on fire, what do? You stop, you drop, and you roll, right? And so stop concept is, okay, stop. Are our patients, are you in, you're trying to induce remission? Are you in maintenance and just maintaining that? Or are you, have you lost maintenance, right? Have you have a flare? Are you trying to recapture it? And the drop is then figuring out, it's a little bit of an urban, but the drop is figuring out, like, what's the drop? What can I use to test? What strategy? Can I use a CalPro? Is it time for a colonoscopy? Can I get an imaging study? What is the right answer for that patient? What's in that treatment plan? And then the role aspect of it is that, hey, is this a high-risk patient in remission? Is this a low-risk patient that's in remission previously? How can I then assess what I want to do? How much slack do I have? How worried do I need to be? Are they just coming out of the hospital? You know, what's my kind of slack? Do I need to see them and examine them, right? And so I think understanding those concepts are super important. So here we kind of have it. Are there any, another question coming in, are there any risk or polygenic risk scores, pharmacogenomic testing to predict what biologic RX might be the best for a particular patient? I think people are working on that in terms of biomarkers. Some of the newer medications are going to be having biomarker trials alongside them to predict response. People do this in cancer care, right? And I think it can be pretty effective.
Yeah, precision medicine. You know, I think there's still a big gap in terms of the data, the research occurring in this space and the clinical applicability. But it's a really important gap that I think we need to close to improve precision targeted therapeutics.
There's some questions on when patients stop treatment, right? And so there's some data that suggests that there are, patients can do okay with stopping therapy. It's a personalized decision, and the data of recurrence is there. But you know, it's a one-on-one personalized approach. And even if you come to that mutually agreed upon work pathway, you never stop monitoring. The treatment, the medication may stop, but the patient's treatment continues. And so it's a one-off thing. I tend not to aggressively stop medications that really work, but there are things that come up, and clearly there's research being done on that. Mm-hmm. So again, just want to remind everybody also that if you have colleagues, again, who have missed today's live program, this activity will be available on the Gastroenterology Hub, on the CME Outfitters website, and which also has additional resources, for there. Both clinicians and patients here. So certainly we have this to have there, and I appreciate all the questions, which have been great coming in. So just want to thank Dr. Benson, Dr. Spiegel for joining me today. Thank you so much for this great program. Want to thank the CME Outfitters team for their assistance in developing today's program. And again, thank you so much to the esteemed faculty for joining me today. And thank you to our audience for participating and making this very interactive.